Dear Mummy, be my Valentine. Love? Question mark. He watched intently as Sonia opened it that evening and feigned amazement, delight, then utter bafflement as to the identity of her admirer. Have you any idea who it might be, Daniel? He pursed his lips and shrugged with his palms turned outward at the bottom of his skinny arms, trying not to smile. For weeks, Sonia kept the card on the mantelpiece in her bedroom. It was the question mark that made her laugh every time she looked at it. When Jacques came back from work, he took to asking her, "How are you, my love? And how is Monsieur Question Mark? How is little Herr Fragezeichen?" As for Sonia, what she felt for the child was beyond words, and she did not really care to examine it. When he had saved with his own money to buy her a present, a useless embroidered purse, the pleasure of receiving it was so shot through with a sort of anguish at what it told of Daniel and of his view of her that the pleasure lasted only for an instant, and she experienced the charming gesture as a sort of memento mori. Likewise, when she went to kiss him goodnight, the last thing before she herself went to bed, she murmured words of utter devotion as she leaned over. As she kissed him and inhaled the smell of him, she felt her whole being shift in her guts and knew that this vertiginous lurch of feeling came about in her because she was really thinking what a short time he would remain a child. The nights could be numbered, and what a short life would be his on earth. In truth, it occurred to her, she was not kissing her child a happy good night. She was thinking of his death. Thank you.
It's very powerful, isn't it, that? And I can see it stirs something very deep in you.
Yes, I find this book almost overwhelming. And it is the character of Sonia, really. For me, she was the one that leapt off the page, and her experience, particularly of motherhood, being a wife. There's certain moments that I can think of, not least when my first daughter was 6 weeks old and I got on a plane and I went to America. And I remember gripping the seat for the first time in my life, thinking I was going to die in an air crash. And I'd been a perfectly confident flyer before then. And it was it's the sort of this sudden intensity of the importance of your life when you become a parent. And the love you experience for your child is something completely other.
When journalists write you up, they like that idea of the sort of the super mum opera star, don't they? This is always part of the story. You know, Ian Bostridge has children. Nobody ever congratulates him for having an opera career as well, do they? How do you feel about that?
Yes, well, I mean, it is the modern conundrum, isn't it, for a woman, whether you choose to pursue a career. Actually, a musical career is tremendously combinable with a family because we don't have the fixed hours. You can do a bit of pick and choose in advance which work you do take. I'm absolutely passionate about both things. I'm incredibly lucky that the two streams of my life are both passions.
And yet I have heard musicians say, I won't name any of them, well, you've got to choose one or the other.
I'm sure that certain people believe that. I don't feel that I've shortchanged either one, but you can never live a different life, so who knows where I would have gone with singing if I hadn't had children. I certainly have no regrets.
Let's move on to your next reading, which I think you may have chosen for small people beyond this room. What's this?
This is David Walliams, and it's Billionaire Boy. Now, I could have chosen any of his books because they're marvellous, and I do lots of reading to my kids at bedtime. And some of the books trip off your tongue easier than others. And these are fantastic. These are so beautiful to read, and they're funny for adults as well as children, and they are shot through with ideas of moral messages.
There's something
messages.
We need to know before we hear Andrew read from this, isn't there?
Yes, you need to know what bum fresh is. Bum fresh is an invention of Mr. Spud, who is Joe's father. He worked in a factory, a toilet roll factory, for many, many years, and eventually came up with the idea of a double-sided toilet roll, one which moisturises your bottom.
Fresh bum, this is called.
Is it fresh bum? Wrong way round, there you go.
Andrew.
When Mr. Spud finally launched Fresh Bum, it was an instant phenomenon. Mr. Spud sold 1 billion rolls around the world every day. And every time a roll was sold, he made 10p. It all added up to an awful lot of money, as this simple maths equation shows. 10p times 1 billion rolls times 365 days a year equals a lot of wonga. Soon, father and son moved out of their pokey council flat and into an enormous stately home. Mr. Spud named it Fresh Bum Towers. The house was so large, it was visible from outer space. It took 5 minutes just to motor up the drive. Hundreds of newly planted, hopeful little trees lined the mile-long gravel track. The house had 7 kitchens, 12 sitting rooms, 47 bedrooms, and 89 bathrooms. Even the bathrooms had ensuite bathrooms. And some of those ensuite bathrooms had ensuite bathrooms. "Can I have a proper present as well, Dad?" said Joe as he put the check in his trouser pocket. "I mean, I've got loads of money already." "Tell me what you want, son, and I'll get one of my assistants to buy it," said Mr. Spud. "Some solid gold sunglasses? I've got a pair. You can't see out of them, but they're very expensive." Joe yawned. "Your own speedboat," ventured Mr. Spud. Joe rolled his eyes. "I've got 2 of those, remember?" "Sorry, son. How about £250,000 worth of W.H. Smith vouchers?" "Boring, boring, boring!" Joe stamped his feet in frustration. Here was a boy with high-class problems. Joe suddenly had a thought. He pictured himself going round the racetrack all on his own, racing against himself. "Well, there is something I really want," he said tentatively.
"Name it, son," said Mr. Spud.
"A friend."
Thank you. In a way, it's quite a traditional story, isn't it? Because it has this kind of the moral imperative of those early children's stories.
They are, yeah, no, absolutely. They're incredibly well done, though. They're sort of not... Because you get a lot of propaganda within the education system when your kids bring home, you know, 5 a day fruit and veg homework and, you know, go running, be active homework, and everything sort of has a message from school. So you come to a book like this, and the fact that the message that he's making is so skillfully handled and so entertainingly portrayed that it's a pleasure as an adult to follow it, but certainly the kids just swept away by it.
How does the fact that you're a performer affect the way that you read to your children? I mean, do you give it everything?
I suppose you'd have to ask them. I occasionally become a little bit self-conscious and think, did I deliver that well enough? But no, I mean, it's great because I love doing it. I love doing it. So, and I think they feel that. They know it.
None of the herons that you've played ever start kind of leeching into your private life, do you? Do they? The operatic mode never takes over, does it?
No, I'm very good at doing a role and leaving it behind. Yeah, very good.
Okay. Well, that's where we have to close the book now, unfortunately. My thanks to Andrew Wincott for reading for us today and to Christine Rice. Thank you for sharing your literary passions.
Thank you.
Matthew Sweet presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Luke Mulhall. And this is Petroc Trelawney welcoming you back to the Royal Albert Hall, where this Saturday night prom features the London Philharmonic Orchestra under principal conductor Vladimir Yarovsky. To finish, the orchestra play a late 19th century masterwork, Tchaikovsky's Manfred Symphony, written in 1885, inspired by Byron's dramatic poem telling of a tormented man deeply anguished by his shaming behaviour in the past, now wandering tortured through the Alps. The critic Vladimir Stasov and the composer Milya Balakirev provided a very detailed synopsis for Tchaikovsky to work from. It's outlined in the programme for tonight's concert, which you can view online right now at bbc.co.uk/proms. Well, when I spoke to Vladimir Yarovsky earlier on, he told me how Manfred was a work the orchestra have become very familiar with.
It's one of those pieces which, unless the orchestra knows it inside out, creates almost insuperable problems technically and musically, because the structure is completely different from any other Tchaikovsky symphony. It's more of a laboratory of a composer, it's a workshop of a composer who is experimenting, alone the amount of extra instruments, organ, two harps, bass clarinet, cor anglais, a huge percussion section. That alone makes it for a theatrical piece.
And you've extended the strings.
And I've extended the strings following the Russian tradition of the 20th century. I mean, the impact which the amount of strings, 18 first violins, give to this music is absolutely unique. And we know that Tchaikovsky has always insisted to have as many strings as physically possible.
It's clearly something of a signature piece for you, because you've been doing it with the orchestra for nearly a decade. You recorded it back in 2004. Generally, it's not performed as often as the numbered symphonies. What is it that attracts you about it?
I inherited the love for this piece from two conductors, from my father and from Gennady Rozhdestvensky, who I think was the first conductor to discover the similarities between this Tchaikovsky and Stravinsky, the neoclassical Stravinsky. Tchaikovsky used this piece as a pretext to experiment with different textures and with the different type of symphonism, much more theatrical type of symphonism, which at the same time led into the neoclassical 20th century. And if you listen carefully, there are segments of the symphony which already remind you of the later works of Tchaikovsky, the Sixth Symphony, Nutcracker, the Queen of Spades. All the later masterpieces are already contained, like in a nutshell, in this Manfred.
Vladimir Yurovsky, who now conducts the London Philharmonic Orchestra in Tchaikovsky's Manfred.
Thank you. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Vladimir Yurovsky conducting the London Philharmonic Orchestra in Tchaikovsky's Manfred. Manfred's symphony in four scenes after a dramatic poem by Byron. The final chorale, coloured by the religious overtones of the organ spelling Manfred's death. In Byron's drama, the last words spoken by the abbot. He's gone. His soul hath taken its endless flight. Whither? I dread to think. But he is gone. Yurovsky, back on stage. Manfred had its British premiere here at the Proms under Henry Wood in 1898. The critic from the musical Times wasn't impressed, finding it a decidedly pretentious work, 1 hour and 3 minutes in performance, he noted. Didn't return to the Proms, this is amazing actually, until 1962. That first Proms performance back in 1898 shared the stage with a Fantasia after Gilbert and Sullivan's The Yeoman of the Guard, which will be here at the Proms tomorrow night. Percussion section of the London Philharmonic Orchestra on their feet. Timpanist Simon Carrington. Brass, now woodwind, bassoons and bass clarinets. Tim Lyons, principal clarinet. John Ryan, principal horn. Ian Hardwick, principal oboe. And Sue Thomas, principal flute. There is, Vladimir Yurovsky told me earlier, an agonising quality about the beauty of Manfred. And that's why I decided to put it together with Weber and Mahler, both of whom have this morbid quality to their music. Didn't catch the whole of this evening's prom, the Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen, the overture to Weber's opera, Der Freischütz, in the first part of the programme. Available to listen again via the Radio 3 website. Television cameras in this evening as well. This prom will be broadcast on BBC 4 next Friday at 7:30. Well, the London Philharmonic Orchestra about to celebrate its 80th birthday season. It starts on the 29th of September with a Russian bell-inspired programme at the Royal Festival Hall. Bells in the Fog by Edison Denisov. Rodion Shehadrin's Concerto for Orchestra, The Chimes, and Rachmaninoff's The Bells. Now though, Yurovsky back on the stage brings the London Philharmonic Orchestra to its feet. We reached the end of this broadcast this Saturday evening from what I think has been the hottest night so far here at the Royal Albert Hall. Not that it's stopped some wonderful music making. Enjoy the rest of the weekend. Good night from me, Petroc Trelawney. Back to David Cornett at Broadcasting House.
Petroc, and just a reminder that there's that other chance to hear tonight's prom on Wednesday week at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And we return to the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow evening, as Petroc also mentioned earlier on, for a prom's performance of Gilbert and Sullivan's Yeoman of the Guard, starting at 7:30.
Children are naturally curious, and schools too often kill and blunt curiosity, partly because of the obsession with exams.
What should our schools teach?
Dance, drama, music, we find difficult to measure. And because politicians don't ask for them to be measured, lots of schools get the message that they're not valued.
A new series looks at fundamental questions in education.
We've just got to change the language, stop using vocational as if we mean not very bright, and actually make that a really valued part of our national curriculum.
The education debates begin on BBC Radio 4 this Wednesday night at 8.
Coming up next this evening, Free Thinking. That's in just under 8 minutes' time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Valse Caprice No. 3 in G flat major by Gabrielle Fauré, played by Catherine Stott. Well, in 45 minutes' time, at 10:30, Sarah Moore Peach will be presenting five new pieces written for the Cultural Olympiad as part of the 2012 festival celebrating some of the UK's most exciting composing talent. The music is by Mark Anthony Turnage, Aaron Cassidy, Julian Joseph, Gavin Higgins, Liz Liu and Andy Leung. And it was recorded across the UK in Edinburgh, Nottinghamshire and London, and it's introduced by each of the composers, with the performers including the vocal ensemble Exaudi, the Rombert Orchestra and prisoners and staff at Her Majesty's Prison, Loudoun Grange. So that's tonight at 10:30. But now here on BBC Radio 3, another chance to hear the psychotherapist Susie Orbach challenging the obsession with personal change in a talk recorded in front of a live audience at the Sage Gateshead as part of the BBC Radio 3 Free Thinking Festival 2011. It's hosted by Philip Dodd.
I wish I was younger. I wish I had more hair, was more patient. I wish. I'm as prone to dreams of change and perfection as anyone else. So it's a great pleasure to have the psychotherapist and author Susie Orbach here to challenge the belief that we can be perfect, to unravel our obsession with change. Now, Susie Orbach initially made her name as the author of Fat is a Feminist Issue, published in 1978. The book argued that body weight is more a state of mind than a physical condition. And she's gone on to write many more books, including a very fine one on emotional literacy. She's been practicing as a therapist for 30 years or so, so she's a fair knowledge in her daily work of all our fears and our dreams. Susie Orbach.
Thank you. Jim's 58. He started to dye his hair. Not discreetly as did men of yesteryear with pomade, but the full Monty, peroxide and L'Oreal, because you're worth it. He's considering having more hair sewn in. He's already had derma fillers and Botox. His mantra is self-improvement. Updating his body is just part of it. He takes classes in Soroka and Mandarin. A makeover to his flat is on the agenda. Spiritually, he goes for the modern pick and mix, Gurdjieff, meditation, and mindfulness. In a previous era, his interests would mark him out as a lively man keeping up with trends. If one was being unkind, one would have said he was having a midlife crisis. Today, a new narrative of choice and constant updating provides the context for his activities. There is a sense that change, personal enhancement, and being on trend is especially valuable. Transformation, upgrading, revamping have become the valued categories of late. But for whom? What does a diet of constant change offer the individual and the collective? What's driving the imperative? Who does it serve? How does it affect us individually and socially? And what are the downsides? I recently visited Beijing and Shanghai, courtesy of the British Council. They say if you leave town for a month, you no longer recognize your neighborhood. Building is everywhere. Our 32nd floor luxury hotel room in Beijing overlooked a 16-lane highway with a 10-lane underneath it. When we asked if we could have a different view, the hotel staff were perplexed. What was wrong? It was a fine view. Hypermodernity is relished. Displaced people replaced by Porsches, Toyotas, Hermes, Estee Lauder and Gucci in mall upon mall upon mall, albeit that no one I met could afford what was in the mall. New buildings and superfast subways emblazon the change, reinforcing the notion and the reality of a society on speed. We're encouraged to embrace the pace of change that mimics the behaviors of orders put into the Chinese factories. New clothes, not every season, but every few weeks, even if there's no money for it. To accommodate this, we can now all have multiple personalities. Like the pop videos that have their stars performing as sex kittens, bosses, mummers, chatelaines, motorbike enthusiasts, acrobats, all in the space of 2.47 minutes, we too can consume the vast range of goods by donning hunting garb on a Saturday morning, albeit we don't hunt, and then a demure afternoon tea outfit later that day. As 6 o'clock approaches, a cocktail dress will suit, and later at night, there'll be sexually teasing lingerie for the bedroom. Changing outfits has been democratized and extended well outside the haute bourgeoisie and celebrity culture. It nourishes the engine of late capitalism. As we spin in constant motion, fitting ourselves to the exigency of the latest must-have, we feed the beast that is the market. Those on lower incomes do not escape these imperatives. Indeed, they're encouraged to buy into the idea, as are the upper and middle classes, that belonging, being a someone, means wearing the clothes, having the car, showing one's stuff. Class is allegedly replaced by aspiration. If you can look the part, you can be the part. The realities of massive social inequality, the greatest we've seen in post-war Britain, is effaced by the carapace to individually self-invent. Change is the cruel poultice offered to soothe the horrors of injustice. The notion of self-invention is worth mentioning here too. It's an appealing idea. Wherever we come from, whatever we've done, whatever mistakes we've made, whatever direction we've gone in so far, we can rethink, we can reevaluate, and we can change. We can become the person we want to be. So far, so good. Who could fault such desire or the endeavor it implies? Why would one criticize the sentiment? Self-invention sounds purposeful and serious. Thinking, evaluating, developing self-knowledge is an essential food for the human spirit. But let's slow down a bit. If we fold in the other ideas that go with it, it's as though one can discard one's past like an unwanted dress or suit. And we can't. People aren't fashion. They have history. They come from somewhere. They have attachments. The most abused, the most ignored, the most hurt, all those who might wish to flee and reinvent themselves, know they can only move forward with the acknowledgement of their past and what they've come from. Otherwise, self-invention means dislocation from history and a deep dislocation from oneself. In striving to be the person you want to be, there may be enormous losses, fracturing and alienation. Of late, I've seen a rather disturbing number of young people who've been on the self-invention path. And inevitably, since I'm a shrink, I see the ones for whom this hasn't worked out so well. Who am I, they say? What do people see? Why am I not feeling good, given the things that I've achieved? Things don't work because the propulsion to self-invent and change has been driven by the renunciation of unmet emotional needs. Reinvention tries to say, I don't need what I didn't get. I'll get it elsewhere. I'll get it for myself. I'll be my own creation and my own object of admiration. But the sad fact is, we do need to understand the impact of not getting what we needed. What's the problem for which reinvention is the answer? If we can't address that question, then consuming markers of status, inventing new lifestyles, will be an endless treadmill benefiting few, least of all those on a quest to feel safe and to find a place of belonging and of mattering. As we know, solutions to things going wrong can start very early. A recent UNICEF report examining why children in the UK were ranked lowest of the developed nations for well-being found that it came from the relentless consumerism offered to time-poor families. Parents are under pressure and consumerism has stepped into the space. Parents have often been under pressure. That's not new. There wasn't a bucolically perfect parent, perfect child time when everything was wonderful. Children were often left free to roam or amuse themselves, and out of boredom, some devised interesting activities to please themselves with. But rarely so now. Relentless consumerism is a demand to change by replacing or adding to our possessions all the time. What kind of horror are we visiting on our children by implying that having things, more things, new things, is the prescription for life? Consumerism is the ugly sister of change. Its pleas for the latest toy and gadgets ring out from every household. Choice and change have become onerous rather than fun. Change purely for profit means that the cultural moment lasts a few months instead of a few years. The designs and aspirations mutate rapidly. It will be hard for people to look back on these times and see the aesthetic imprint of a decade in the way that we can readily identify the 1920s, the 30s, the 40s, all the way up through to the 80s, actually. Perhaps that doesn't matter, but I'm not so sure. We don't live for the historical record, but neither are we ahistorical beings. The idea that we'll pass on something, make the world a better place, leave something to be remembered, has been our custom and our cultural contract. But how realistic is that contract today? Perhaps our artists will do that for us. I hope so. The voraciousness of change is affecting us badly, socially, environmentally, and individually. Therapy is often characterized as a change technology. Some might argue that the whole point of therapy is to change. Certainly, therapies are sold that way, and no one enters therapy looking to stay the same. Indeed, I'm not arguing against change itself in this lecture. That would be ludicrous. Change is part of the human condition. It's what makes us and defines us as humans. We develop, we do things differently. We aren't moles building the same kind of hill over and over and over again. Human consciousness and existence is predicated on the capacity to change and develop. There are few things more delightful than watching babies take their first steps or discovering one can actually communicate in a foreign tongue after the huge efforts of learning the grammar and vocabulary and stumbling inarticulately for ages. So it's not change itself that I'm contesting, but the commercial harnessing of the idea of change, which brings in so much destructiveness. Therapy of the psychoanalytic kind, that's my job, is more concerned with exploring the problems and impediments to change as one's in the process of change. People come to therapy not to change, but because by and large they're in difficulty with themselves. Something, some things, or indeed many things about their experience are not working. They've exhausted their personal emotional resources. They're frustrated. A crisis, often precipitated by loss, propels them to seek the reflective space that therapy offers. As they try to find the words and the feelings for what so hurts, the experience mutates. It doesn't disappear, but it sits inside them differently. The experience isn't split off, disowned, or repressed in a manner that is undermining. It becomes instead known and thus integrated. That ownership is transformative. It constitutes change. Not the kind of change that's about the dismissal or rejection of self, but a change that occurs as a result of acceptance. Therapy is a challenge to the notion of the rational. Or perhaps I should say, it limits what we might understand as rational and how far we can go with rationality as a concept. We live with the ideas of the subjective and objective realms, often disparaging the former and elevating the latter as though they were into two entirely different modes of thinking, being, and feeling. In truth, this division is unsustainable. Subjective and objective thoughts and feelings are the outcome of different knowledges that are related. The subjective, which is often seen as personal, idiosyncratic, and intuitive, sits on and is entwined with structures of thinking which are designated as logical, deductive, and analytic. If we pause and consider how we use this unreflected division, it becomes apparent that the way an individual, be they a barrister, a cook, a parent, a dancer, makes a logical, analytic argument is always with reference to their own lived experience. The rational, sealed off from experience, has no salience. It can wreak havoc. Let's not forget an important part of the current economic meltdown, the reliance on the mathematical physicists known as the quants, who in their first large-scale outing at the Long-Term Capital Management Fund lost nearly $2 billion while owing over $100 billion in the space of just 3 weeks back in September 1998. That was rationalism at its maddest and most manic. And so too is the notion that the subjective is a deeper, more authentic truth, spurious. The subjective is always structured by the cultural rules and practices we've imbibed, almost without realizing it. It's not a better truth or a more valid truth. It's just an aspect of a personal truth. For change to have meaning rather than being just a phenomenon of rapidity, we would do well to make it a more complex idea. There are many different kinds of change today, but change isn't good and it isn't bad. It isn't one thing. Change, in my book, requires something of us. Change that's worth embracing picks you up and offers you a challenge. It's an impingement, stimulated either internally or from the environment. It demands a response which is active, thoughtful, and which, as we engage it, grows us. Perhaps the rate of change that I grew up with following post-World War II, which seemed to be about an evolution and was about progressive change until about 1976, is what alarms me about the imperative of change today. That period gave people a chance to engage with change, to roll it around your mouth, to taste it. This constituted a form of engagement. You saw what it was made of, and you could find your way in it. The interesting thing about Occupy Wall Street and all of its exuberant offshoots from Antarctica to our very own Occupy the London Stock Exchange, now embedded at St. Paul's, has been the very different way in which participants are going about thinking through political protest and how to bring about change. The daily General Assembly and the work groups are characterized by an attempt to include multiple voices and not close down discussion into a narrow list of rhetorical demands. If we start with the movement in the USA, we can see that having lived through the assault on Obama's promise of change we need, they are going about change very differently. They don't have concrete demands. Partly there are too many disparate views to coalesce around a series of demands so far. But as one participant told me in answer to the criticism that their action is idealist, too broad, and needs to focus to achieve reforms, the belief in reform could be said to be the definition of an idealist. Working on the problem of how to bring about change is being a realist. Occupy Wall Street is a political intervention. It's a political process. That is its political product. This is its very original contribution to very much needed political change. Learning how to talk and think, strategize and organize, include and define is the challenge to our inert political arrangements. Bob Dylan's The Times They Are A-Changing rings in my ears as I end this lecture. This hymn for and from the heart accompanied the most extraordinary social change in the United States, from the civil rights movement to the student movement to the anti-Vietnam protests, including the soldiers sent to fight there. It went on to engage the Chicano, Latino, African American, and women's liberation movements. What marked those movements was a new kind of organizing, talking, and debating about change, which was the inheritor of the Port Huron Statement, the enunciation of participatory democracy as a basis for the collective. It produced profound changes in the participants because, as individuals and as a group, they took up a very different kind of psychological and political space. This seems to me what's happening in the Arab Spring, in Tel Aviv, and now on the streets of America, Spain, Greece, Frankfurt, and the UK. It's a messy change, to be sure, the kind of change that challenges us. As Naomi Colvin and Kai Wagala, supporters of Occupy the Stock Exchange, write, "Our response to systematic failure is not to propose a new system, but to start making one. We're in the business of defining process. We ask people to stop seeing themselves as consumers and start seeing themselves as participants." And so I conclude. This kind of challenge isn't easy, but in its demand, it magnificently embodies a complexity which is the antidote to the synthetic and commercially driven change all around us today. Thank you.
Susie, I want to ask you, I mean, there's a lot in what you've said. I want to begin with the consumer element. Let's say you're right about consumerism, about the way it drives change. We're almost in pantomime season.